We're going to be doing a little series on the life of David and how God developed him into a person and a leader of quality through trials and tribulations. But in 1 Samuel 8 through 15, we don't really get much information about David. This is more about Saul. And so we're going to be looking this morning less at the qualities of good leadership, more the qualities of bad leadership, because Saul was pretty much a failed leader from the very beginning. He had his moments of glory, but for the most part, overall, Saul was a failed leadership. But before we get too much into this, I want to get some context of where we are. And I thought about putting this on your outline, but there just wasn't room. We get a little timeline here of where we are. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, Samuel is the prophet and priest, and if you can think back a little before that, Samuel, in fact, I read this verse last week as part of the sermon series, or part of the sermon was 1 Samuel chapter 1 or 2, when Hannah is praying for a son. She just desired a son deeply, and she's crying and just pouring her heart out to God at the temple, and Eli, the priest, comes to her and says, "Are you drunk, woman?" She says, "No, my heart is just so heavy." And Samuel came along after that. And as part of her promise, she gave Samuel to the Lord and left him at the temple when he was weaned. So Samuel was raised up in the temple. And he was a godly, godly young man. If you remember, Eli, the prophet, the priest whom Samuel studied under, he wasn't the best guy. And his sons were worse, if that was possible. And consequently, they both died, and Eli died. Basically, God took them out. But God raised up Samuel, this godly man. Ironically, when we get to 1 Samuel chapter 8, we find out, or 7, I think it is, we find out that Samuel's sons were the same as Eli's sons. They were reprobate. And no one liked them because of the way they had polluted things. Now, back to the timeline. This follows Samuel and Eli kind of come at the end of this period of about 300 years of when Israel was ruled by judges. And for the most part, the judges reflected Israel as a nation. Israel was a constantly failing God, constantly being chasing other gods, and then just not living up to God's standards. And the judges pretty much, for the most part, were about the same. Some were good, but overall, the judges was not a great period in Israel's history. And of course, if you go all the way back about 400 years before, that's when Israel exodus from Egypt. So, here's the history of Israel to this point. They've come out of Egypt, they've wandered the wilderness for 40 years, they've come into the promised land, they've chased out their enemies, they've had this leadership of these judges. It's been okay, but you know, it was kind of a reflection of Israel, who Israel was. And so, when we get to 1 Samuel chapter 8, this is the history. This is what's been going on. And in 1 Samuel 7, verses 15 through 7, we find out where this is going on, what happens in 1 Samuel is going on. Samuel's home was in this little town called Ramah, which is just north of Jerusalem, which at that time was not at all the capital of Israel. And what Samuel would do, we find this in 1 Samuel 7, is that every year he would travel from his hometown to Gilgal, to Bethel, to Mizpah, and back to Ramah. And he would do his work in this little region right here. Israel at that time would have gone from somewhere down here around the bottom of the Dead Sea up to just north of here off the map. So here's Samuel's leadership comes just in this little tiny area right here. And this is also in the tribe of Benjamin. That's where this region is. And that becomes important in a little bit when he anoints a person from the tribe of Benjamin. Ramah, in a sense, would have been like the capital of Israel. although there really wasn't a capital, because at this time Israel was ruled by judges, and they didn't have a centralized government. And it was a bunch of tribes. It was 12 tribes, and they all had their own elders and things. It was kind of a loose network. So there really wasn't a centralized government, and there was no capital per se. But Samuel was the role of both priest and judge. He communicated to the people what the will of the Lord was. So we pick up in 1 Samuel 8, verse 4, with the elders of the various tribes in Israel coming to Ramah to talk to Samuel. He's the one who can communicate with God, so they come to him. 1 Samuel 8, verses 4 through 9. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and said to him, "Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done, from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them, and show them the ways of the king which shall reign over them." Now obviously there were some issues with corruption that existed because of Samuel's sons. Another issue was the encroachments of the Philistines, this Indo-European group that they settled here along the coast of Judea, and they're a threat to what's going on in Israel. The main protection that Israel would have had from the Philistines was Philistines kind of settled down here in the plains, and it's more mountainous up where the Israelites were, so the terrain was a little bit of a hindrance. But nonetheless, they've got these two things going on. They've got Samuel's sons who are reprobate. Samuel's getting older. And then they've got these Philistines who are settling along their borders. And so they begin to wonder, how in the world are we going to survive? They can't comprehend how being under God would work to defend against the inevitable invasion of at least the Philistines. So their call for leadership from a king said less about their faith in Samuel or his sons, and more about their faith in God. Because don't forget, Eli and his sons weren't great rulers either. And God raised up Samuel, right? This godly young man to rule, or to be the prophet and the priest. So, could God not also take care of the problem of Samuel's sons? But they couldn't see it. These men wanted a man that they could point to as their leader. A man who would represent them to other nations and strike fear in the hearts of other nations and thus discourage them from invading their homes. It was no longer enough to look to God and point others to Him as their defender. Though that's how, in the first place, they even got this land. I mean, they looked to him then. He was the one that routed the enemies and gave them this land. And yet, they don't trust him to defend it for them. So God reassured Samuel that they're rejecting God and not Samuel. And he also warned of what having a king would mean for them. God, through Samuel, pleaded with them not to reject God, because it would mean heartache and disappointment down the road. He knew that. Still, all they could see were the benefits. The Israelites thought that they knew better than Samuel, or better than God, either one. They ignored the warnings and demanded a centralized government with power resting on the shoulders of one man, rather than trusting God. Now, one of the major problems that comes with trying to govern, and be it in business or politics, is that you have to come up with formulas to deal with problems. If a person does X, then Z happens. Let's say, let's use the speed limit for an instance. If a person goes 53 miles per hour in a 50 mile per hour zone, they've broken the law, right? So what's supposed to happen? An officer should write them a ticket and give them a fine for exceeding the speed limit and for breaking the law. That's the formula. Now that formula, 100 years ago, wasn't necessary. There weren't that many cars on the road. And so they could kind of deal with those situations as they arose. But as the population on the road began to grow, there became this need for a formula. How are we going to deal with this situation? Now, as the Israelites now are seeking a king, they're at this time, kind of like when there was no speed limits, when situations were kind of dealt with on a case-by-case basis by these men that God had chosen. And they don't think that's going to work anymore. They want a formula. They want a king. They want to entrust everything to this one person. Because that's what all the other nations were doing. They wanted, if you will, a big government instead of a God. And we all know how well that works, don't we? Because we've experienced that. But they didn't have any idea. As a whole, they were unfaithful. And they had unfaithful judges as a result of that. Otherwise, they had available to them the most effective form of government, a theocracy, a true theocracy. They were governed by God. And so, when God says to Samuel, "They're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me," that's exactly what they were doing. They're saying, this theocracy thing, we don't like it. We want a king. Someone we can see. Someone that we can point our neighbors to and say, here's our king. Look at him. He's our leader. He represents us. So fast forward a little bit to 1 Samuel 10, verses 17 through 24. Go ahead and turn to 1 Samuel 10. God revealed to Samuel, who in turn revealed to Saul, that Saul would be the king of Israel in response to the people's demand. While it was clear that God did some things in Saul that and moved in him and did some powerful things through him and worked in visible ways, there were also some indications, even early on, that Saul had some serious character flaws. The most obvious foreshadowing came at Mizpah, which is one of those towns that Samuel would visit, where Samuel comes to publicly proclaim Saul as the chosen king. The scene opens like this, 1 Samuel 10, 17 through 19. Now Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah, and he said to the people of Israel, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But today, you have rejected your God, who saved you from all your calamities and your distresses. And you have said to him, 'Set a king over us.' Now therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your thousands." So he's given them one more reminder of what they're doing in seeking a human king. Today, you have rejected your God. That's a harsh statement. I mean, you have rejected your God. But it doesn't seem to faze them at all. Even despite what a harsh statement that is, they seem to just go right over the tops of their heads. So Samuel organizes the tribes and then continues with revealing the one God had chosen. Verses 20 to 22. Then Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. He brought the tribe of Benjamin near by his clans, and the clan of Matrix was taken by lot. And Saul the son of Kish was taken by lot. But when they sought him, he could not be found, So they inquired again of the Lord, "Is there a man still to come?" And the Lord said, "Behold, he has hidden himself among the baggage." What in the world? They're looking around. Okay, it's the tribe of Benjamin. And it's of the clan of Matrite. And Kish and his son Saul. Where is Saul? So they, "God, where's Saul? Oh, is there someone else?" "No, he's hiding." That's almost unbelievable. That a man chosen as king would be hiding. And don't mistake this as humility. This is something different than humility, because if you read the rest of Saul's life, you'll find there was no hint of humility in this guy. This is evidence of a serious character flaw. And it was also like another warning, this one from Saul himself, that they are rejecting a fearless God who faithfully protected them in favor of a man, and a man who is going to hide when things get tough. And that's exactly what he proved to be. He would run from high pressure. He was going to be a continual disappointment for the nation. Another unheeded or perhaps unnoticed warning is pointed out by Matthew Henry in his commentary. You see, Jacob had prophesied centuries earlier on his deathbed that the line of Judah was going to be the one that was going to produce rulers. And Benjamin's line, which, don't forget, that was Saul's heritage, is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey, and in the evening he divides the spoil. This happened hundreds of years earlier. Jacob, on his deathbed, is prophesying Judah is the one through whom kings will come. Benjamin is troubled. But these guys missed that too. And it's not that they needed to catch that, because they'd already been explicitly and directly warned that this was not the way it should be. But despite all these warnings, what do they do? Verse 23. "Then they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, 'Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? There is none like him among all the people.' And all the people shouted, 'Long live the king!'" Don't miss the irony here. It's as if Samuel is saying to the people who've gathered, "Okay, folks, you've gotten exactly what you asked for. He looks great, doesn't he? He's the guy that you want to have standing up and saying to the world, 'There's our king.' He's head and shoulders above everyone. Even though he's hiding the baggage when he's looking for the king, he stands tall. He's a Lone Ranger type guy. Look at this man. He's our leader. Long live the king." The Lord chose Saul intentionally, knowing he would be a weak leader because of his lack of character or his lack of desire to be changed. Saul had a few moments in which he showed good character and judgment, but overall we see Saul exemplifying weak leadership driven by a lack of character. Let's examine some of these instances. In 1 Samuel 13, 8 through 14, the account of Saul as the Philistines are invading. Saul up in the mountains, the stronghold, and the Philistines are lining up for battle. Saul's got his army, he's ready to go. He's waiting for Samuel to come. Samuel's delayed in coming. In the meantime, Saul's army is getting disheartened and disenchanted, and they're deserting him. So Saul, under pressure, decides that he's going to offer sacrifices, which, in case you didn't know, that's the priest's job and not the king's job. And so he makes this foolish decision to offer sacrifices. In desperate times, Saul ignored God. And then there's another instance in 1 Samuel 14, 24 to 38. Again, in response to tough circumstances, Saul acts in desperation. He made his army vow not to eat anything until the evening or until his enemy was avenged. And so they come into the forest, as the account goes, and somehow there's honey dripping. I'm not sure, I didn't do the research, but there's all this food around. And the army comes in, they're so tired from a long battle, and they need to eat. But Saul has made this vow that they can't until evening or until the enemy is avenged. So these guys are just dragging. Now along comes Jonathan. He hasn't heard this vow. Dips the end of the staff in and eats some of this honey. And all the army's like, "What have you done? Jonathan! You broke the vow!" Jonathan's going, "What?" Because Jonathan didn't know. "Why did my dad make a foolish vow like that?" And it becomes a big mess. But in the end, it prevented them from plundering the Philistines, as they could have easily done. Then there's another one in 1 Samuel 15. You probably remember this one. This is Saul is instructed to just utterly destroy the Amalekites. And he doesn't. And when he gets called on it, he refuses to accept any responsibility for it all and blames it on the people. All these people. And the list goes on even until his death in 1 Samuel 31. You don't have to turn to that one. But even in his death, there's failure. And after his death, as Saul is gone, and he's got these military leaders that were under his authority, they continue to make havoc because they didn't want David to be the king. They wanted to maintain their power. So Saul's was a history and a legacy of failed leadership. Because Saul had no character. Now I want to back up to 1 Samuel 15 again. And go into this story of the failure of him to defeat the Amalekites, because this is kind of a turning point for Saul. He's got this army is numbering over 200,000 men that could have easily wiped out the Amalekites, and they definitely had the upper hand. But again, showing his lack of character, he ignored the part of the command that might limit his prestige and power. He's got these Amalekites right where he wants them. He outnumbers them. He's got them. I mean, he can do anything he wants to with them at this point, knowing he has the upper hand. And seeing the great plunder that's available, he says, "No, I'm going to take this king, Agag. He make a pretty neat trophy. Keep him alive. I'll show all these other nations around what kind of a king I am. That'll teach them to come after us. And it'll give me some clout with my people too. Oh, and you guys, there's all this good livestock. I mean, the best of the best. There's no sense in just destroying that. Let's keep that." And so as a leader, he's thinking to himself, "Okay, I get two things here. I get some power and prestige through Agag, keeping him. And I get the favor of the people, who they've worked hard for this too. They should deserve some reward out of this." And so you know the story, I'm sure. Samuel finally comes to the scene. He walks up and, Saul's all proud because he defeated the Amalekites. And Samuel's like, "Well, what's this bleeding of the sheep that I hear?" "Well, there's the people," Saul says. "The people, you've insisted that we keep these things." But Saul failed to lead the people to obey the Lord. And so, at 1 Samuel 15:10, the word of the Lord came to Samuel. He said, "I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. The Hebrew used in verse 11 is this I regret is a really good translation. It means to be sorry or to repent or to regret. So God regretted making Saul king. But God already knew what Saul was going to do. He warned the people this was going to happen. But I think there's something else going on here. This is some sort of a watershed moment in Saul's life. A change. He's changed course. That changed the course for God. God had this planned out. But here's Saul fitting right in with what God had planned out. By this act of disobedience, that not only was disobedience for him, it led his people into disobedience. So with this act of disobedience and a failure to lead his people to follow God, Saul had ended his tenuous position of blessing from God and set into motion the original plan of God to put into place a godly king from the line of Judah. Now there's numerous lessons that we can take away from this long passage of Scripture. Well, I want to get a couple of them. First of all, are we willing to trust God even when we don't understand the practicality of what He says? Really, I think about there's some things that they just don't make sense to us. Are we willing to trust God in those situations? When the Israelites faced pressure, they thought in practical terms. The Philistines are coming in. The leaders we have right now aren't the best. We need a king. We need someone to protect us. We need someone to look to and point other nations to as our leader. So that we're not just this hodgepodge of people camping out up here in the wilderness. We need this. They think in practical terms. And so they fail to trust God. They forgot what He had done in the past. And indeed what He was doing then. And we can draw that same conclusion from Saul. Saul didn't trust God under pressure either. The other lesson I think we get out of this is the title of the message. Character matters. God can and does change character. We see that especially in Saul, as God gave him a spirit. We read, especially early on, we read where God gave him a spirit, and he prophesied, and he did do some mighty things. So God can do that, and God does do that to accomplish His purposes. In the end, however, Saul did not surrender his will to God's. And thus Saul's character never became any better. And the result was a string of troubles that ended his life and continued to negatively affect others even after his death. I want to focus on these things in the coming weeks as it relates to leadership. And this would seem like a good, if you're going to talk about leadership, you want to be in a leadership seminar, right? I mean, you talk to pastors, you talk to people who are in positions of leadership. I realize that there's a tendency to kind of, if you don't see yourself as in a position of leadership, when someone starts talking about qualities of leaders and how leaders need to act, the tendency of many to just kind of tune them out at that point, because, hey, I'm not a leader, I'm not in a position of authority. But that doesn't change one's responsibility to pursue excellence of character. Saul failed as a leader because he lacked character. Lack of character will lead to failure in any area of life, regardless of your perception of what position of leadership you may have. And write this down. You are more of a leader than you think you are. You are. Just because you may not have an official position of leadership, you are more of a leader than you think you are. If you're a Christian, you're a leader, at least in your setting an example of who and what Christ is. Now, as you're reflecting Christ, does character matter? Absolutely. So it doesn't matter if you're the mayor of the city or the principal of the school or whatever other position you think involves leadership. If you are a follower of Christ, you are reflecting His character. And so character matters for you. If you want to experience success as you lead people to Christ, it starts with character. You can't lead someone to Christ if you're not reflecting Christ, by the way. It doesn't work. Because they look at your life and they say, Christ? I don't see anything special about you. Why should I follow Christ? So we need to deal with our character.